This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, movie critic Matt O'Lean reviews Clint Eastwood's new film, Cry Macho. But we are going to start with our monthly journalist roundtable. The special guests are Jack Zaleski. He is a columnist and former editorial page editor for Forum Communications, and Cecile Werman, editor for Journal Publishing, which puts out the Crosby Journal and the Tioga Tribune. They speak with Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson.
Cecile, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
Cecile is on the phone from Crosby in our Fargo studio. Hi, Jack. How are you doing?
It's good to be with you again, Dave.
I guess I just wanted to start with this continuing COVID situation in North Dakota. I mean, we're almost to 1,600 deaths in North Dakota. We've got 3,600 active confirmed cases. And Cass is number one in the numbers. Burley County is number two in the numbers. But if you look at per capita, Burley County is number one. So, Cecile, what's the situation in your area?
Well, we started seeing an uptick in cases just with a bang on September 2nd. We had not had any activity for quite a while, just a sparse case here and there, I think over the last 2 months of summer, maybe just a couple of cases. And then all of a sudden on September 2nd, we got five, which for a county of, 2,200 people, that's mm-hmm. pretty significant. That's near the biggest amount we'd ever gotten in a single day ever. And then the cases just kept rolling in to the point where I think earlier this week we were up to 39 or just the low 40s that we had just since September 2nd. So after a period of very little activity, for our small community in Crosby, that was significant.
There seems to be a lot of blame on anti-vaxxers, people who are not getting the vaccination because they have moral objections to it or some other type of objections to it. What are you seeing in your neck of the woods, Cecile, about vaccinations? Do you have figures?
Well, overall, I think the last report we had, which was a week and a half or so ago, we were right around 50% overall, but when you get into the under 40 and under 30 crowd, those numbers are much lower. For teens and young adults, we're in the low to mid-20s as far as fully vaccinated. And the new cases seem to correlate because those cases were primarily driven by school activity. Mm. It was young people in the school, teachers, were the most of the new cases that we suddenly had.
So, Jack, in Cass County, you're seeing, I think, higher vaccination rates.
They're higher than the state overall, but there's still a significant number of people who are resisting. And I think every time one of the medical professionals from one of the big hospitals or public health is interviewed and the question is asked, are the new cases that are being admitted to the hospital or being identified among people who have not been vaccinated, it's something like, 93-95% of those cases are people who were not vaccinated. You don't have to be a public health expert or a mathematician to figure out that correlation. And so we're still seeing a result, one of the results of the anti-vaxxer group is more hospitalizations of people who, for one reason or another, are not vaccinated. That's putting significant stress on the entire medical delivery system in a city like Fargo. Beds are scarce. They're trying to add more beds. Sanford is. And it's taking a toll on people who need to come to the hospital for other reasons and are told maybe they're going to have to wait. So there's a lot of fallout from this business of choosing not to be vaccinated. And not all of it is, these personal decisions do have a consequence for other people.
And we're also hearing that they might have problems with filling some medical positions that might be coming open because some people have decided to step away because they're just suffering from COVID fatigue.
That's exactly right. We're hearing a lot of that there are all sorts of incentives to get people to come to work or to come back to work. But what you described, David, is just exactly what's happening. They're burned out, or they're afraid, because you've got some people who just put them at risk when they come into the hospital, and they've been working for more than a year now. Some of them under conditions that are would be difficult for anybody, but are extremely difficult because these are caregivers. They want to help people. And they're unable to do it the way they their profession has trained them to do.
Now, speaking about getting burned out, we did a story a little while ago about some school board members who decided not to run for re-election because they seem to be getting burned out because they're getting beat on a lot by both sides of the mask debate. And in Fargo, four school board members were going to be recalled, but it appears that the recall failed. So, Jack, tell us what happened.
Well, not only did the recall effort fail, it failed spectacularly. When the signatures were sent into the school district for validation, they have a very careful process of validating signatures. The result came back with not just a few signatures here and there, 10, 20 that might have been wrong or wrong addresses or, something that would invalidate them. There were four separate petitions, and there were hundreds, in some cases over 1,000 signatures that were not valid, that were invalidated. So the level of – what's the word? The level of incompetence on the part of the people who were running this recall effort is evident in those numbers. So the recall is for now is dead. They have to wait, I forget how long, a couple of years before they can do it again if they want to. But the signatures were coming from everywhere except the Fargo School District, where the law says they have to come from. I mean, there were signatures from Bismarck and Minot, and there were signatures from Moorhead and Dilworth. You know, the kinds of things that should not happen if you're serious about getting a petition right. Like I say, it wasn't just a handful of signatures. It was hundreds and thousands.
Well, there is a lot of COVID news that of course, is related to COVID. But I wanted to get both of your reactions to the new guidelines for the booster shots, especially for the Pfizer vaccine. People aged 65 and older residing in long-term care facilities, people aged 50 to 64 with underlying medical conditions, people who are 18 to 49 with underlying medical conditions, and people of working age who are at increased risk of COVID-19 exposure and transmission due to occupational settings. Cecile, what are your thoughts about those guidelines that have been released today?
I was really pleased to see that it went beyond the 65-plus age group, and selfishly maybe that's because I have a husband who's just beneath that and now will probably qualify for a booster. And I won't for a while, but for my mom, for other loved ones, I'm just happy to know that they'll get that extra shot. And, I feel pretty comfortable myself. I finished my series in April, and, everything I'm reading tells me that I'm still pretty darn safe. Mm-hmm. So, I don't want to take a dose away from someone who could use it, and would much rather see those more vulnerable people boosted. But, this kind of plays into something else that's in the news this week, and that's rationing of the monoclonal antibodies.
Yeah.
At a time when we're talking about boosting some people, we have got to get more people getting their first two shots, because up until now, monoclonal antibodies were widely available in North Dakota, including the small critical access hospitals like we have here in Crosby. And now that there's been a change in how the government's going to take control of the distribution of that, apparently due to short supply, that treatment will not be available in Crosby. And that means that if you get COVID, a treatment that could, very easily keep you from being hospitalized is no longer going to be available. And our hospital administrator indicated that even Minot is going to be very, very short. So
yeah.
that remedy is kind of off the table in rural North Dakota right now.
Yeah, and the remedy itself, that remedy you described, Cecile, is extremely expensive compared to getting the shot. And
right.
And so, it's I forget, $2,000, I think, a treatment, something like that, compared to the well, free in the sense that you don't have to directly pay for the shots. But
right.
But you know, so it's I mean that's a problem, and I think we're going to see more of that. Part of the reason I think, and I was listening to an analysis by some health experts, that there was some, and this is a kind of the dark side of this thing. There was some suggestion, you know, not direct statement, that, well, in these places where people don't want to get the vaccines, let's just move those vaccines to places where people do want to get them. And that's a harsh thing to do, and I don't think anyone's doing that because the vaccine's available everywhere, I think, across North Dakota, even in counties where there's very little, where the rate of vaccination is low. So, but there is that thought out there, and that's a result, again, of, you know, this disagreement people have about the vaccines.
This is going to be an interesting rite of history when we get through with the pandemic part of it. And, of course, there's all sorts of research that suggests it's going to become endemic, like a flu. Mm-hmm. And J&J, Johnson & Johnson, I think, is talking about trying to work on a combined flu and COVID shot. So there are a lot of things happening. And you did mention monoclonal antibodies. That's a nationwide shortage, too. They've just
right.
They're running out of it. So,
yeah.
I need to switch to a topic that perhaps may be a little bit more esoteric, but could have some interesting implications down the road. And this is legislative redistricting. So, Cecilia, you've been following it in your area.
Yeah, we're not going to see. Well, I guess for us here in Divide County, we're not going to see a big change. Our district boundaries, we're District 2, are going to change in that a portion of the growth area in Williston, or out just outside of Williston, will no longer be a part of our district. All of our legislators, including Don Longmuir, who was a representative from Stanley, will all be eligible to run because the boundaries are not going to change enough to impact anybody's seats. And at one, you know, I guess at some point, you know, being on the edge like that, you know, Stanley could still maybe fall one side or the other, but that's not what they're talking about right now. But an interesting result of that, if the current proposal were to go through, is that I understand the District 2 Democrat chair, party chair, will no longer be a resident of District 2. And, you know, the party the Democrat party in this area has been, you know, fairly inactive, very difficult to get candidates. We didn't have a slate of candidates from the Democratic MPL last go-round. And now they're losing their chairman if this districting goes through.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Williston. Williston going to get that second district. Fargo, Jack, it sounds like you're going to get another district there.
Yeah, Fargo will get a new district that I think pretty much was drawn by Senator Solvac or Representative Solvac. Anyway,
Senator Solvac.
And it straddles the Fargo-West Fargo line. It's a large new district, a growth district, which will make Cass County, I think Cass County will then have 11 districts just in Cass County. And that is a significant legislative clout in one county.
Of course, you're talking 11 out of 47.
Right. So, they don't all agree all the time. They don't always vote together all the time. It's not like Minot voting for a pig barn at the state fair, you know, but it is an awful lot of legislative representation in one county. And, 22, which was always considered a rural district, is almost like a suburban district now. And the new district, I'm not sure what the number is, will represent that growth area on the south and west Fargo, and south and west Fargo and west Fargo areas. That's just growing. It's just hard to believe every time you drive out there how much it's growing. So, it's going to be an interesting – and the shift, you look at the numbers not only in the far west where there's been some stability and some growth because of oil, mm-hmm. But you look at the other places that haven't had oil in the last 10 years, what this census represents, the north central part of the state, the northeastern part of the state, some of the south central, smaller and smaller and smaller. The district's probably geographically larger. I haven't seen the new map yet, but that trend has not changed in decades, and oil and the growth in the valley has not helped those parts of the state.
Cecile, I want to go back to you for just a second because in an mm-hmm. earlier email you mentioned about a miscount or say undercounting.
Yes, it really doesn't, in the small numbers that we have, it isn't that it's going to make a difference as far as the district boundaries, but it sure will make a difference as far as the money coming to local political subdivisions. And when they claim that every person counted is some $19,000 worth of federal mm-hmm. income potentially. But, we could, in our small townships where you only have, five, six families in a township, and, then the census says there's only three people there, and you know all of those people yourself, and you know that there's 12 or 20 people there. Our county commissioner was talking at a meeting this week about the block in Crosby where his daughter lives, and they only had, some small number of people listed for that block, and he went, down the list of, well, there's this person and that person and that person, and, it was like four times what the census had recorded. Mm-hmm. So that's frustrating. Like I say, I don't see a lot of, ultimate impacts as far as representation go, but the money end of it, boy, that's a huge impact.
Yeah, that is, especially the smaller the community.
That's sure.
makes
mm-hmm.
makes a big difference. I think part of that came from the last administration's attempt to really denigrate the census and to mess around with it. And some people who are of that political persuasion didn't cooperate with the count, didn't answer the door, didn't fill out the forms. And so some of that, I'm not saying that happened up in your area, Cecile, but it happened in some areas where people decided they weren't going to participate in the census in large part for very crazy political reasons rather than, any legitimate reason. Mm-hmm. So that undercount.
It was actually, I think they actually had too many options for how to answer it.
Yeah, that too.
Almost.
Sure.
I mean, there was so much confusion. You could call, you could send it in, you could mm-hmm. Get on the internet, and different people did, answer right away and get on the internet, and then there was confusion about, then they'd later get a packet, and they weren't sure if they were counted, and, the rollout, I was actually on the census committee here for our county, and we did a lot of public awareness and several events to try to get people to answer, and there just was a lot of confusion about the whole process.
One thing that you also hear is that people on the reservations, the tribal governments, are saying they were undercounted too. But that leads me into a little comment and maybe a discussion. There is a serious discussion going on in that committee about creating sub-districts around the reservations. And that would give the Native Americans the chance to have their own representation in the legislature. Good idea or bad idea?
Well, I think, you look at the history of the legislature, Dave, and you know this better than anyone I know. When you look at the number of Native people, Native American people from reservations, not necessarily Native people who don't live on the reservations, mm-hmm. but people from the reservations, it's what you can count them on one hand maybe over the last 20 years or so.
And so...
If you're talking about representation from the reservation communities, there really hasn't been much. And if there's a way to do that and do it fairly, not only to the reservations but for the reservation's neighbors, I hope the committee could find a way to do that. I don't expect that to happen.
You don't?
I do not.
I've just seen some preliminary maps mm-hmm. that were drawn to create sub-districts. Mm-hmm. But there are some people who say, well, if you're going to create sub-districts for these areas, you've got to create them all over the state. And the law is pretty silent on that particular.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
It is kind of interesting.
I like the idea of sub-districts only because, we've got a pretty large geographic area, and, as Jack was mentioning earlier, some of these other places that have lost population, when you've got towns that are 60, 80 miles apart, there's different geography, there's different issues, and, it's hard to know a candidate, that's from 100 miles away and think that they're going to represent you well.
Yeah, that's true. You look at that district in the southwest, it stretches from what? Almost to Watford City, down to the South Dakota line, mm-hmm. to Bowman. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the size of Delaware, for God's sakes. And with not a lot of people in it, but people who should be represented. But it's hard to know your representative or your neighbor when your neighbors are a couple hundred miles apart, 150 miles apart in some cases. So, yeah, sub-districts could solve that. But, you know, there's always been a reluctance to add to the number of people in the legislature. I think at one time we had, 52 districts, Dave?
53.
We're looking at, 47 now?
47, which has been, since the last 10 years, it's been 47.
Right. And so, you know, 47 districts. And in that 10 years that we're at 47, the population of the state has grown significantly, and the geographical distances have grown significantly because the population in some of these in some of the rural areas is diminished. So there should be a better way to do that, so the representation is closer to the people that are supposed to be represented in the legislature.
Do you feel that the process has been open, or are better ways to do the process? And the reason I say that is because it's online now. So,
yeah, you know, it's, as a news person, I guess it's hard to cover state issues that are so far away, and you know, having the online option is certainly better than not being able to go at all. But it's just hard to feel that you could have an impact as a citizen. Appearing by, you know, by Zoom or watching by Zoom, you know, what is the mechanism truly for someone to have an impact on that process? I mean, you can watch, but I don't know that they're not really taking comment mm-hmm. to any degree.
No, I agree, Cecilia. They had a live session here in Fargo, went all day, and in the middle of it went all day from early morning to in the evening, when most people are working, when most people can't take the time to go and find out how their state government, an important, very important function of state government, is working. And so these things it's almost as if they were designed to minimize public participation. I mean, the people who put them together will disagree vehemently with that, but the result is pretty clear. Even here, with this large population base, I think some of the media covered it, but you can't sit there all day. You just can't do that. And the attendance and the participation was mostly by people who had some sort of an interest, you know, lobbying groups or special interest groups. They would be there, but for the average citizen who, you know, wants to know what's going on with legislative redistricting, the process is not necessarily user-friendly, and maybe that's just the nature of it. You know, it's really not that interesting, to tell you the truth, unless you're a wonk like we all are.
Yes, that's right.
So it happens, and I think people sort of don't even know it's happening, and when it does happen, and it's done and for 10 years, and that's it. So, and I don't know how you'd make it better. I really don't know how you'd make it better, but it's not that it's not open, but it's open in a way that doesn't make it easily accessible.
That's Jack Zaleski of the Forum, and we have Cecile Werman of the Crosby Journal, and I'm Dave Thompson, and we will be back with more after this news.
Good afternoon from the Prairie Public Newsroom. I'm Todd McDonald. North Dakota's COVID-19 death toll has now reached 1,597 after two more residents with the virus passed away. According to the State Health Department's coronavirus dashboard, 645 individuals from 44 counties have tested positive. Today's results are from a batch of 10,552 tests for a daily positive rate of 6.45%. There are currently 3,604 active confirmed cases statewide. Of the new cases, 136 were found in Cass County, 112 in Burleigh County, and 62 in Stark County. A detailed map of all new cases from each county is posted on our news page at news.prairiepublic.org. The director of North Dakota's Airline Commission says in August, the 8 commercial service airports in the state saw a decline in boardings when compared to July. Kyle Warner says traditionally August does mark a slowdown. He says the numbers we have now aren't unexpected, and the decline does not dampen the spirits.
Well, we're kind of at a little peak at this point, so we saw quite a bit of growth, particularly this last spring and summer, due to an incredible amount of pent-up demand and leisure travel.
Warner says at 82,000 boardings in July, the numbers are still down 15 to 20% from pre-pandemic levels, but he still says it's a manageable situation.
When I say 15-20%, too, when you look at the 2019 numbers that we're actually comparing them to in the pre-pandemic era, that was an incredibly busy year for airlines as well. And so, you know, to give some perspective, we're actually still doing pretty darn good.
Water says while recreational travel saw a return over the summer, the challenge now is to get business travel numbers restored.
But we still have the best airline service really that we've ever had historically in our state when you take a look at the destinations and the flights that are available for to our flying public. So we've actually sustained the difficulties over the last year really well.
An invasive bug recently found in Kansas could spell trouble for agricultural states if more are confirmed. Harvest Public Media's Katie Pikus has this report.
The spotted lanternfly has bright red hind wings with black spots. It may look pretty, but Iowa State University entomologist Donald Lewis says this pest and its, quote, piercing, sucking mouth parts feed on sap, which will weaken lots of fruit and woody trees.
Eventually, these insects could feed on the sap from dozens and dozens of different kinds of plants, causing problems for us.
The state of Kansas and federal officials are investigating after one of the bugs was found in a 4-H project. Native to Asia, the spotted lanternfly was first seen in Pennsylvania in 2014 and is a skilled hitchhiker. The Iowa and Nebraska Ag Departments have both received possible sightings of the insect, but so far they've all been false alarms. Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
And from the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
Dave Thompson here. We're back with our Editor's Roundtable. We have Jack Zaleski, who is the retired editorial page editor for the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead, but still writes a column on occasion. And we have Cecile Werman from the Crosby Journal. And Cecile, when you mentioned in your email a topic that you had that you wanted to talk about, it was interesting. And what are you talking about with this Sons of Liberty situation?
Well, we're all going to be learning more about this group next week in the Tioga Tribune, as our reporter has been interviewing some of the people involved in this. And I haven't read his story yet, but I can just give you kind of a first blush. This is a grassroots group of, I guess you would say, conservative activists who are not happy with the representation that they have in local or state government. And so they are holding regular meetings in the Tioga area that are addressing, you know, an array of issues from being unhappy with vaccine mandates for healthcare workers to trying to recruit people to run for and get involved in local government. And they first came on the scene, or we were aware of them, back during the GOP district committee meeting last spring, and one or two of their people were elected to the district committee. And they claim to have 400 members. And so I think it's interesting that, you know, at a time when North Dakota has a supermajority of Republicans, and the Democratic Party is just really collapsed. I mean, it's very hard to keep an engine going when you know, maybe have 25% of the population. So that sets up the need for some kind of, you know, somebody to oppose, so to speak. And so now it seems that people of a more conservative persuasion are talking, you know, together about, you know, what they're not happy about. And it looks like there could be some changes.
You know, that's interesting because we have this Bastiat caucus in the legislature too, and we don't exactly know how many people are in the Bastiat caucus, but they're doing some of the same things too, trying to organize at the district level or maybe getting people on school boards or local city commissions. Jack, there's been some movement around that in Fargo too, hasn't there?
Well, I think what you've seen in the school board thing is a symptom of that kind of thinking. When you really look into what is moving that school board recall and some of the complaints with the school board has little to do with good public education. It has more to do with an ultra-conservative political agenda and trying to affect curriculum in ways that would be steps backwards. But we have not heard, I have not heard until now, and it's interesting that of a group officially, you know, Sons of Liberty. Interesting that there are no Daughters of Liberty, but you know, maybe that's the way it's going to be. So.
I know there are. In the group, in fact, the secretary of their organization is a woman, and she is the was recently appointed as the Tioga City Police Commissioner. There are definitely women involved, and in fact, this group is apparently getting more active as time goes on. In fact, on Tuesday morning, they plan a demonstration, I'm told, at Tioga Medical Center, addressing the vaccine mandate for health care workers.
Oh. Okay. Well, I'm kind of curious because I get emails from a group calling themselves the Sons of Liberty. I'm wondering if they may have a national organization that's an umbrella to this organization.
Well, I didn't do the interview, so I'll be learning along with everyone else as I read our reporters' information. But what I understand is they claim no affiliation, that they are a standalone group. But, yes, there is a larger organization called the Sons of Liberty. But what those connections are, I couldn't say.
Yeah, we have the same phenomenon here that the agenda that is being pushed by some of these local folks, and again, the school board recall was part of that, is they don't claim that they're being influenced by anybody from outside North Dakota, that it's strictly a grassroots thing from Fargo and from North Dakota. But when you look at the same kinds of things happening in other places with the same agenda, with almost the same language sometime, you know, you have to wonder if there is not some kind of, if not a formal arrangement, there's some sort of informal connection that's helping drive the agenda of these folks.
Be looking forward to that series of stories. Should be very interesting.
When does that go, Cecile?
We'll have a story this coming week, and anticipate it's probably going to be a two-parter.
Oh, that's great.
Okay.
Over the next couple weeks, we'll be learning more about what their goals are and who some of the personalities are.
Mm, great.
Okay, let me completely go 90 degrees off everything. We talked about redistricting, and there's a special session coming up in November, but they're also going to be taking a look at this $1 billion from the American Recovery Act, the ARPA money, the American Recovery Plan Act, and how to spend that. And I'm going to ask you both, what are you hearing about priorities in your regions?
Well, frankly, we haven't heard very much about priorities in the region. I mean, there are a lot of needs, there are a lot of projects going on, a lot of proposals. Priorities, not sure what would fit as a priority for that money. It's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money.
It's a big chunk of money, and the legislature, you know, has got a pretty heavy responsibility here to spend that properly and make sure it's invested well and make sure it's applied so that it does, you know, help the state. You know, there are a lot of needs, and we all know the needs that come up at the legislature all the time. But there are going to be a lot of people wanting to get their hands on that money. You know, there's always the roads and bridges stuff, the county bridges, the county roads, the township needs, and that sort of thing. But I think the state and the rest of the country is waiting now for this new legislation in Washington, you know, the infrastructure funding. Mm-hmm. So there may be some reluctance to spend this $1 billion on those kinds of projects because that money is still coming down the line. I don't know. It's in a lot of ways, it's It's bonus money. It's mad money. We're going to have all this money to put to things that we might not really need, but we really want. There's always flood in this part of the world. There's always needs to complete the flood control projects and the flood control systems along the Red River and the Cheyenne River and the Wild Rice River. That's going on. There's an awful lot that's been done since 1997 and 2009. Almost the levee systems are pretty much almost completed, but there are always needs, and so it's going to be interesting to see what the legislature identifies as needs.
Cecilia, you're not hearing very much at this point, are you?
I'm not hearing much at all, and I'm so thankful that that Jack covered it very well. But I would just say that when you look at what it is that we need. Especially in rural North Dakota, better access to mental health services and addiction services is huge. And I don't know what it's going to take. I don't hear anybody talking about spending that kind of money on those issues. But that would seem that social safety net type of a thing would seem like something that is definitely in need of improvement. And I hope there's somebody out there who might have some influence on the process who can raise that issue.
Well, I can tell you that the Democrats have held press conferences and that Senator Mathern from Fargo is kind of driving that train too, that he's got some proposals he's going to bring up in the upcoming special session regarding the social safety net. So things worth watching. And Cecile, just because I think it's a segue, it's not a very, very clean segue, but it kind of brings you to a subject that you brought up about the North Dakota Newspaper Association working on this North Dakota News Cooperative. So can you talk about that?
Yeah. We've had a committee for a number of years called the Future of Newspapers, and several different initiatives have spun out of that. The most recent and the one that we've worked on for about 2 years already is the idea of providing more quality journalism of statewide significance to all of the newspapers in North Dakota. As a small town publisher sitting here, you at like just like the redistricting question, how much time do I with one reporter or two reporters in my newspaper do I have to spend on a statewide issue even a local issue that has statewide significance? And so the idea would be to hire a veteran journalist to delve into some of these issues that impact more rural areas or impact everybody, and the kinds of things that would be more investigative, more long-term, and be content that would be open for any newspaper to run. And so that group has recently applied for a 501c3. They have some seed money from the North Dakota Newspaper Education Foundation. They're pursuing funding from other journalism-friendly grant sources, and hope to actually begin advertising and possibly hire a managing editor around the first of the year.
Wow.
I mean, that is such a marvelous idea. The Forum several years ago started the Forum News Service, but that's mostly member papers that are members of the Forum, owned by Forum Communications Company. And that network has proved to be regional in scope and has been a source of good news and features, sports also, throughout the whole region. But that's different because most of these places are in the larger markets, Duluth and Dickinson and Jamestown and Grand Forks and Rochester, Minnesota, places like that. They all feed the news service. But there's still, I think, there's a gap. There was a time, I think, Dave, you might remember this, when papers like the Minot Daily News had somebody on the desk and all they would do all morning is call the sheriff's office, sheriff's offices in a dozen counties around their area and have a great report on what was going on in those counties. Nobody does that anymore because, frankly, even the bigger operations like the Forum and others don't have the resources to do that anymore. So if what Cecile's described can come to fruition and people who would have access to it for, I imagine, a fee you'd have to pay for it, I would hope,
Actually, the idea is that this is going to be member supported and grant supported, and it's going to be a service to the North Dakota Newspaper Association members.
Oh, well, see that would even be better, because if you could have someone who's focusing on those places that the larger media markets just don't have the resources to focus on or choose not to. Boy, I mean, you look at a town like Fargo and you could stop 10 people on the street and six of them are going to be from rural North Dakota.
And they have
an interest. They have an interest in what's going on. And I hope this comes together. That sounds really, really something that would make all our publications so much better.
So do I. And I think it raises the boat for all media, whether it be newspapers. It might get us in broadcast to maybe up our game, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's really really the idea is to raise raise the boat for everybody and make sure it's quality, that it's contextual, that it's a trusted source, and make it available to to any small town publisher and big publishers alike. And I have to say, we didn't come up with this idea all on our own. There's the South Dakota News Watch. They've been doing this for several years. We're kind of patterning ourselves after them, but, maybe a little different. And another really exciting aspect of this is a news literacy prong that would be attempting to do something in schools to educate people about trusted news sources and, why newspapers are important and, what to look for in bias versus objective reporting and that sort of thing. So that could have an even bigger impact, in my opinion.
And we're going to have to stop it there. Thank you both so much for the discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
That was Jack Zaleski, columnist and former editorial page editor for Forum Communications, Cecile Werman, editor for Journal Publishing, which puts out the Crosby Journal and the Tioga Tribune, visiting with Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson. Madeline is next.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra welcomes you back to MSU's Ann Nicole Nelson Hall for their season opener on Saturday, September 18th. Motley Soiree will feature over 50 local musicians performing works by Tchaikovsky, Bieber, and Weill. The Sub-Zero Winds and Diana Anderson perform Poulenc's Sextet for Piano and Winds. Tickets for the live performance or live stream are available now at MinotSymphony.com.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
When you hear the fanfare, that means it's time for another movie review with Matt Olin. Matt, you have been off to see Cry Macho. This is the new Clint Eastwood film.
Starring and directed and produced by Clint Eastwood at age 91. Who knows? This could be the final film of his career. We're not sure. I mean, he's a healthy man. He walks good. He does not walk with a cane. I admire him for still working. But this film's a mess. It's a bad film. And most of his films in the last 10 to 15 years, in my opinion, have been bad, his directed films. And I've been very harsh on him as a director. I call him a cookie-cutter director. There's nothing interesting about the shots he chooses. He telegraphs every emotion. I think the casting in his films is a big issue, and I'm going to get to that in just a minute. So this film is based on a novel in which I believe the character was supposed to be a little younger than Clint is playing in this film. That's problem number one, is he is probably 20 years too old to play the part as it's written in the novel.
Okay.
So Dwight Yoakam plays a ranch owner who employs Eastwood as a ranch hand, and he sends Eastwood to Mexico to retrieve his 13-year-old son. Now, the son lives with the mother. The mother is Hispanic. Dwight Yoakam is white, so this is a half Hispanic, half white youth living in Mexico, and he wants the son back. So, of course, he sends Clint Eastwood down to Mexico City to retrieve his son. So this is such a bad movie, and it's contrived. the script is terrible. I mean, there are lines like, oh, man's got to make choices, you know, things like this that Clint will say. It's like it was churned out of an assembly line for bad script writing.
like the after school
when
special.
He gets there, I want to point out one of the more ridiculous parts without giving too much away. So, you know, once he makes contact with the son, they need to get back to Texas, but the son's mother isn't happy about this, so they're being chased by the Federales. So in being chased by the Federales, they pull into this very small town, and Clint says, this looks like an interesting town. Let's stop here. And they spend over a week there. Wouldn't you want to get back to the Texas border if you're being chased by the Federales? I would, but as we learn in this movie, without giving a plot away, it's a plot device to introduce new characters. He's also kind of a Dr. Doolittle. So Clint Eastwood, his character, Mike Milo, has this ability to cure animals. And this becomes a side plot that's very ridiculous as well. People bring him their animals to cure. Someone brings a sheep that has a huge bloody gash, and in 2 minutes he sends it away and it's fine. It's
and
just,
they know how to find him in Mexico.
Well, once he stays in this little town, the word grows that he's good with animals, good with horses, and they bring their animals to him, and he magically cures them without any remedies, without any medicine. So it just gets more and more ridiculous. And I really felt bad for the young actor who plays the boy that he retrieves. Eduardo Manette is his name. He's bad. He's a bad actor. Hmm. He shouldn't have been cast. It's probably not his fault, but it's Clint Eastwood's fault for casting him. The great director John Huston used to say, it's all about the casting, and then you let the actors do their job. If you're casting someone that's not right for a part, that can't handle emotional scenes, that's on you, Clint Eastwood. It's not on the kid. Find a better actor. And this is another, you know, a major problem with the film. What I can't understand, Ashley, is this film has a 53% positive review on Rotten Tomatoes. That's the critics, okay? And some of the critics that gave this a good review are big-name critics. And I'm not going to name names, but they should know better. I just don't see what they're seeing. They're either seduced by Eastwood's stardom. They don't want to criticize a 90-year-old working man. I don't know what it is. Or they just can't figure out the mechanics of filmmaking. But even at that point, most of these film critics come from a writing background. They should be able to spot a bad screenplay. And so I would say this, if people want to go and see Clint's farewell performance, which it very well could be, go ahead. I'm not here to tell you not, but I'm here to analyze the film as I see it. And like a lot of his more recent films like J. Edgar and the 1517 to Paris and Jersey Boys, it's just not good. It's almost plays like an after school special for adults. That's how I would almost view this movie.
Is it a commentary on the border situation? I mean, you talk about people getting chased down at the border.
No, there's none of that. It takes place in 1980. So it's based on a novel. There's no commentary on that. It's this bonding film between Eastwood and the boy. That's really what it's supposed to be. It's overly sentimental. Things move way too quickly in the movie. Relationships are established too quickly. The boy who is ostensibly in trouble in Mexico, as Dwight Yoakam tells Eastwood, you know, this kid's into cockfighting and things like that. By the way, Macho is the name of the boy's rooster that he uses in illegal cockfighting. So
they're grappling with masculinity.
They're grappling with masculinity. There's a lot of scenes about, you know, Macho is overrated and, you know, you have to make your own choices. And it's all contrived. It's all telegraphed. I've seen it before with Eastwood's movies. He's made some good movies as a director. Unforgiven, The Outlaw Josie Wales, Bird. But the last 10 to 15 years, if his name wasn't Clint Eastwood, if he didn't have four Oscars, there's no one to tell you no. When you've won four Oscars, there's nobody to come in and say, Clint, we need more takes. We need better casting. This isn't working. There's no one to tell you no. He has carte blanche, and that's the problem.
Well, I knew it would be too easy to ask you Clint Eastwood's Oscars, but Clint Eastwood is basically as old as the Oscars.
Pretty close.
They started in 1929. He was born in 1930. So in the year 1930, so for films for 29, actor and actress.
Was this Warner Baxter in Old Arizona gets Best Actor, and the great Mary Pickford won Best Actress for Coquette.
There you go. We've been to the movies with Madeline. Support is provided by Benedictine Living Center of Garrison, providing long-term skilled nursing care, short-stay rehabilitation, outpatient therapy, and assisted and independent living. A member of the Benedictine Health System, blcgarrison.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 24th. On this date, in 1921, the front page of the second section of the Fargo Forum Saturday Evening Edition led with the article headline, Arikara Indians Stage Ancient Ceremonial at Fort Berthold. For the second time in 40 years, the spectacular and beautiful ceremonials of the Arikara Nation of Indians on the Fort Berthold Reservation have been given. They were presented the week of August 15th at the reservation through the efforts of Dr. Melvin Gilmore, curator of the North Dakota State Historical Society, and Alfred Baer of the Arikara Nation. Dr. Gilmore made records of the ancient rituals of the celebration for preservation in the files of the society. Dr. Gilmore's records at the State Historical Society of North Dakota include these remarks. In old times, there were rituals and ceremonial celebrations connected with the various community activities throughout the cycle of the seasons each year. But in later times, since the United States government has reduced the various Indian tribes from the status of free peoples to that of subject peoples and wards, they have been restricted from the celebration of their own seasonal ceremonies. All the 57 varieties of people we have imported from the Old World are freely permitted to carry on their peculiar institutions, the Jews with their Yom Kippur and Yom Teruah, the Norwegians with the 17 de Mai, and others with their own peculiar Old World institutions. But people of the Native American race, who are loyal and true Americans and nothing but Americans, are prevented from celebrating their own age-old festivals. The Fargo Forum went on. These ceremonial observances of the Arikara are spectacular and impressive, filled with religious fervency, poetry, and dramatic art. They partake somewhat of the nature of the miracle plays of the Christian Church of Europe in the Middle Ages, such as the Passion Play of Uberammergau, somewhat of the historical pageant, and somewhat of the spectacular ceremonies of the Pueblo Indians of our Southwest. 1921 featured a rare convergence of circumstances where ethnologists got access to indigenous religious ceremonies, and Arikaras felt comfortable enough to let their mysteries be seen by strangers. The Arikaras built a ceremonial lodge made of wood and concrete and would involve Dr. Melvin Gilmore in their rituals one year later. Such events for ethnologists created an opportunity for Arikara ceremonies despite federal repression of indigenous religions. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, October is right around the corner, which is National Arts and Humanities Month. We get the latest arts news from Kim Conoco, the Executive Director of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.